This is sex. Everyone gets what they want. This is sexploration.
Explore.
Play.
This is Sexploration with Monica.
Sex is proof that God loves us and wants us to have fun.
Sexploration with Monica on FCCFreeRadio.com. This is Sexploration with Monica, and tonight we're going to talk about, well, the things about sex that maybe you don't think about, like pleasure activism, why being a sex worker is actually important to society, why it doesn't, in fact, destabilize the social fabric, because I think many people, they believe that maybe sex workers are damaged, or maybe that they're making choices from a place of not being empowered. We have some very empowered, very intelligent women in the studio tonight. Kitty Stryker, welcome.
Hello.
Sandy Bottoms, welcome.
Hello.
And our token straight guy tonight is Paul Brumbaugh, comedian.
Hello, everyone.
Hey. Okay, so Paul, you have a new show. It's called Get Your Fill on Sundays from 6 to 8. And you've always been doing The Edge of Insanity from 4 to 6 on Sundays.
That is correct.
Awesome.
And it's really great to be in such good company tonight. So thank you, ladies, for having me here.
Oh, shucks.
So, Sandy, you've been working at the Lusty Lady, which is the only unionized, what do we call it, a dance club, exotic dance club?
It's a unionized and cooperatively owned peep show.
So it's worker-owned.
Worker-owned, and right. It's one of the last peep shows around in the nation, and it's one of a kind.
Right, because it's got the little box that you sit in, and then the window opens when you put in a quarter.
We've, you know, raised our rates with inflation. It's now a dollar.
It's now a dollar. Okay, that's good. Tell me about what it's like to work there. I mean, first of all, I bet it's a lot different than having to work at another kind of show where it's not as self-oriented. Like, you don't get to... I imagine that you have a little bit more flexibility in what you look like. You don't have to be blonde. You don't have to be... You know?
Correct. Yeah, it's a lot different than working in a traditional... Yeah, it's a lot different than working at a traditional strip club. You know, for obvious reasons, it's behind glass. You're not doing a hustle the same way as you would in a strip club. Instead of being treated as an independent contractor like you would in a strip club, you are hired as an employee.
Which sometimes you actually have to pay to work at strip clubs.
Yes,
which is
most
kind of insane.
Yeah, most strip clubs you actually have to pay to come to work, and you know, you could leave at the end of the night with nothing.
Right. Or just pay them.
Or having to pay them.
And it's like a slow night or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's insane. Why do you think people work in those environments? Because there's no other option, or because sometimes the money's good, or I mean, pay to work? Ooh.
Right. That's what is out there. That's the kind of the only thing available to women and men who work in strip clubs. The standard is independent contractor, and every club has mirrored each other.
Well,
and
because they're like, we can get away with doing independent contractor. Sweet. We don't even have to. They can pay us.
Right.
Great.
Right.
And I think that there's kind of this history of exploitation of women who are willing to be sexual. Do you know what I mean? And also being like, oh, we can make a lot of money. We can have a 2-drink minimum. We can have the girls pay us.
Yeah.
Do you know?
And there are opportunities to make a lot of money in strip clubs. Mm. It's possible to live and live well under those circumstances. You know, and some clubs are definitely better than others. Not every single strip club, you know, has standards that are really low. But that is the general tone, that they profit off of the work of others. And that's, you know, that's general capitalism.
Right.
In its true form.
That's true. Ew. So, yeah, exactly. Like, oh, how little can we pay the workers? Mm-hmm. We have real estate. So let me introduce Kitty Stryker a little bit more. You both are working with SWOP, which I just learned about, that Sex Worker Outreach Project.
Mm-hmm.
Kitty does also work about size activism, and we're going to talk about the female gaze, which is, especially at strip clubs, there's a lot of that male gaze, right? Like, that's designed to, at least we have this idea of what men want to look at, or I don't even know if that's what men really want to look at. I mean, do men really want to look at women with big boobs and small waists and blonde hair all the time?
Well, if that's all that's available, then,
right. Then
you know,
they're like,
that's
right.
What they're stuck with.
Just look at what's in front of us. Seems okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But at least what I know from my own boyfriend is he's always talking about like how he likes something that's a little bit different than what everyone else thinks is the ideal.
Well, I think what's really interesting for me as the Lusty, as someone who is a customer, is that I feel like the Lusty provides a lot of opportunity for the female gaze. I mean, you know, I can not only be entertained by the variety of the girls there, but also I have a thing for thigh-high socks, and, you know, the girls there totally provide for that, so that works for me.
Thigh-high socks there, okay. Tell me about the setup at the Lusty. So just for someone who's never been there and or is listening maybe far away, we have listeners in Kazakhstan.
Hello there.
Hello, Kazakhstan. I love you. And Armenia. I love Armenia, too. I do love Beijing also. So all of you guys listening. The Lusty Lady is basically a dance sex club, right? So you could like watch people dance and be sexy as they're sort of scantily clad and getting maybe slightly more scantily clad as you're watching.
Well, we have two different entertainment areas. We have our live stage, which is where we have three girls dancing naked behind glass. Completely naked, more or less.
Okay.
Yeah. Our one rule for the stage is you have to have your boobs and your cooch showing.
Oh, okay.
That's the revealing portion. Unlike a strip club, it doesn't have a beginning and an end because windows are continuously popping up around you and different
right.
people are coming in. So you're kind of doing like a continuous movement, naked, taunting sort of
right,
thing.
Right, because many different people are watching at different times.
Yes.
Sometimes someone will pay a dollar now and then later and then there's another one.
Yeah,
so
and
it's
people,
like a show for a long time. How long are you in the booth for?
You are... In that booth, as a dancer, you are doing that shift for maybe 4 hours, maybe 2 hours. It depends on the kind of shift.
So continuous dancing for 4 hours.
Yeah, and we have breaks about every half an hour, so there's plenty of downtime. But you are more or less under somebody's gaze
kind of
for 4 hours.
Yeah, right. Okay.
And surrounded by mirrors, so everyone's looking at each other, and you can see what you're doing as well.
Oh.
Yeah.
Huh. Is that good?
It can be. It certainly can be.
You would have to want to like to look at yourself. Clearly.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, definitely, if you have issues with, like, if you have issues with your body image or if you have, you know, things, you have, those come up. Those are definitely, that's definitely a place those things come up.
Yes. Interesting. And do you interact with the other girls?
Absolutely. We, you know, have a lot of fun on stage. There's lots of giggling, dirty jokes, you know, a lot of bonding goes on. Especially.
Can people hear you in the booths?
People can hear you. We can't really hear customers just because of the acoustics, but they can definitely hear us.
And so they make hand motions at you a lot?
Yeah, we get,
or they write
notes? We get notes sometimes. Sometimes they're really sweet. Really sweet. You know, and there's definitely a lot of, like, body communication that happens through the glass. Yeah, you'd be surprised. Even without the verbal communication, like, you can really get a lot across.
Interesting. And so that's the first entertainment area at the Lusty Lady. And then there's a second area?
There is. There's something called Private Pleasures, which is a one-on-one booth. That's where one girl's behind glass and can do more explicit shows. So you can do masturbation, role play, toy shows, whatever you name.
Right. And so that's kind of like the person who's going in there and paying says, you know, I really want this.
Yes.
And then the other person is like, oh, yeah, I can totally do that.
Yeah. And it's all about consent. You know, girls only do and, you know, the things
whatever
they want to
do.
And they have a lot more control. But so do the customers. So you get a lot of couples coming in wanting to do like experimenting things. They want to role play with another person. It's definitely a place to come explore.
So like someone could be like, well, I would, if you are interested, you could make out with my girlfriend kind of thing.
It's all
or
behind
is it
glass.
Just watching?
It's all behind glass.
Oh,
you can
okay.
hear each other. Unlike the main stage, the rooms are mic'd.
Oh,
so a lot more communication can happen. But, you know, if they have fantasies about having a threesome, but they're in a monogamous relationship and they don't feel open to that, this is kind of a way they can explore that.
Right, because it is sort of like a sexual dynamic, but you have the safety of the glass wall there.
Yeah.
So you can always say, yeah, there was no other person even in the room.
Exactly.
Tricky.
Sounds like a loophole to me, doesn't it?
No, it's totally a loophole. But hey, we like loopholes.
Yes, we do.
Sometimes you need the hole in the sheet to make it safe and good, I guess. If you need the hole in the sheet, we could put a hole in the sheet for you.
I wanted to ask a question about the first staging area where you can have like up to three girls. It sounds like the second staging area is a smaller, more intimate, like you used to remember in the movies or stuff, where it's like a room with the wall goes up and it's just kind of like a small little closet to a small little closet almost.
Yeah, it's definitely more loungy. So you're generally sitting or laying down in there as opposed to like dancing and teasing like the other stage.
Right. Now, in the section one, how big is that stage area? You said there's three girls, and it almost sounds like it's in a roundabout because you have windows going all the way around.
Yeah, there are 12 windows. So the length of the room is probably like 10, 12 feet and by like 5 or 6 feet. And there's like a strip pole there, and you can actually like move around. There's a lot of space to use up.
Well, there you go.
As a customer of the Lusty Lady, you think that there is space for the female gaze there. You think that...
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Mm-hmm. And I find it really interesting because I actually brought an ex-boyfriend to the Lusty once, and because, you know, he was from the UK. He had never experienced anything like that before. And we had a great time. You know, we enjoyed watching the girls. It was interesting being exes and being like, so what do you think of her? Yeah, she's pretty cool, huh? Like, it was a very sort of dude bonding thing. But then we tried to go to a peep show in the UK, in London, and we found that they didn't have enough room in any of the cubicles to actually have two people in there. While the Lusty has two handicap stalls. Which is A, really cool for disability stuff. Right. It's awesome to have a handicap stall and have that available. But it's also cool if you've got a couple, you've got enough room to kind of maneuver a little bit. You get a little creative in there. When I go in there, I like to put on a show for the girls. So I like to bring somebody and be like, hey, I remember a Fleet Week, actually, where one of the girls asked me to bring back a sailor. And I did, to her surprise. And he was a disciplinarian for the Navy. And I gave him a bit of a discipline show, and it was hilarity all around.
You've been very bad.
Turn the tables on him, right?
Oh, yeah.
What's the difference? What's the difference for a place that's set up for women to enjoy what they're watching? And what's a place like where it feels like women feel maybe out of place? I mean, what's the difference in the vibe?
I think what really helps with the dynamic of a peep show, actually, is having space. So you're not actually interacting with all of the other customers. You're in a booth by yourself or with your partner. While at a strip show, for example, you might be up front where you've got guys who are getting a little rowdy. So you might feel a little more out of place. You might feel a little more uncomfortable. So it's a very different dynamic. If you're a woman in a strip club, you can end up feeling like you're part of the show.
Yeah, and definitely. Guys have this weird facial expression that they use sometimes at strip clubs that feels very critical and very like, kind of hungry and dissatisfied all at the same time. Like they're kind of walking around.
It can be very predatory.
Like kind of like, murr. And you're like, I don't know. I felt really kind of awkward. I was at one of the places on, I don't know if we call it the Strip here in San Francisco, but it's Broadway in Columbus. It wasn't a peep show. It was like this with the stage and the dancers and everything. And while I would say that most of the dancers were pretty friendly, they weren't too friendly, you know. I mean, they didn't like talk to me, but not that I had a bunch of dollar bills, which is, you know, in all its fairness, not that they had any good reason to talk to me. But also, the guys were, they just looked like they weren't even having fun. You know what I mean? Like, I'm like, why are you here if you're not happy about it? You know, like, why are you scowling and looking around like, meh?
Well, I think speaking from the guy's perspective, I think there's different reasons we go.
Sure.
You know, one is just being lonely. One is frustration. And sometimes being at a club like that doesn't relieve any frustration.
Right.
At least not in the here and now. Right, maybe later. Right. Fantasy time.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it could just make that exponentially more frustrating or whatever emotion you happen to go in with. You know, like whenever I've gone into a strip club, you usually see a couple different types. It's the partiers. It's like the sailors, the rowdy boys, the bachelor party guys. Or it's the older guy that's been going for a while that probably sticks to himself. Or the guy that, man, I really just don't want anybody to see me in here. I need to come in, do my business, get out. And so that's probably the look you're thinking of because they're kind of scowling and they're kind of like, I'm hoping nobody will notice me. Or if they notice me, you know, they don't start talking to me.
Yeah, they're feeling shame and feeling like they're doing something wrong.
Right, and that's why I could see how the Lusty Lady would be really, really great for a lot of guys because you make that one-on-one kind of connection. Right. There is the safety of the window. But it sounds like it's a different, the girls have a totally different vibe.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and everything's different about it. And, you know, it is still sex work. It's very, you know, similar in a lot of ways. But, you know, we have different practices in how we're hiring. We hire girls who know about the co-op. They know about the union. They're coming here for those reasons. We accept people of all body shapes, you know, all sizes, all races, unlike other clubs. Mm-hmm. And people come in with a different attitude. A lot of people are coming with a true positivity, and they want customers to leave there with that. Mm-hmm. And it's not that competitive edge that you feel in strip clubs elsewhere, because we're paid on an hourly wage. You don't have to fight for every dollar you make.
Well, it's also like you kind of said also in the beginning, you said they don't have to all be the thin waist, the big boobs, the mm-hmm. blonde hair. Quite honestly, speaking from a guy that's I won't say middle-aged, but a guy that's been around the block a couple times, I like all women. I mean, all shapes, sizes, genders. That was good.
Whatever
works for you, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, there isn't one specific type, and it's really good that you do have that, because it's probably sets you guys apart from everybody else.
Absolutely.
Well, I think just going back to the strip club thing for a moment, I think also it can be a reminder to men that they are always the customers. And that women are always the ones who get paid. Mm. I know for my boyfriend, that's something he struggled a lot with the adult industry, that it feels like men are always the consumers of female sexuality, and that women are always the projectors of that sexuality.
And like, they don't have any sexuality themselves.
Exactly.
Like, they don't have the sexiness. They're not worth getting paid.
Right. Sex is something that women have, and that men
they sell it.
Pay for. Right.
Yeah.
You know, and that I think can also have a really negative impact on men. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's, you know, capitalism and sex work can be difficult and uncomfortable for everybody.
Totally.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
especially when you really want like actual love or just attention, and you feel like, well, I don't know where to get love or attention, so I'm going to go to a strip club, and I'm, you know what I mean, and like trying to find that.
Well, and this
really
is another
place.
Is another thing I think that's really cool about the Lusty, is if you are a guy who goes in and does a show for the girls are really appreciative.
We love it. So we love getting shows.
You know, as
Define
a guy.
Define show. What's getting a show? Let's talk about what a show is.
You know, I love having exhibitionists come in, you know, people that really want to like have you watch them get off. Like they are into you watching, and they want your attention. I'm really into that, as long as it's a consensual thing.
How do they ask for consent if you can't hear them?
I mean, there's definitely, you know, in a private booth, that's what you do.
You know,
they say, yeah, I want you to watch me do this thing, and that's awesome. You know, sometimes if you're on the live stage and there's like three windows open in your section, you can't be giving all your attention to one person. Mm-hmm. So at that point, you know, if they're getting pissy with you because you're not paying attention to them, and they're like communicating with their hands in a negative way, you know, that can be a problem. But for the most part, we love when people come in and do their thing. You know, we love having people come in with toys, like, you know, or weird piercings or little costumes. That just makes our time that much more fun.
Oh, that does sound fun. So let's talk about how this affects your, I'm using finger quotes, real life. Have you experienced any like negative reactions to you doing work at the Lusty Lady?
Absolutely. I started doing sex work about 2.5 years ago, and I have been very vocal about doing sex work. In addition to working at the Lusty Lady, I have been working in other strip clubs. I've done some porn. I've done some other things, and I'm pretty out about it. Most of my family knows to varying degrees. Friends and potential partners, like, they need to know off the bat, because that's who I am. Mm-hmm. Not everybody's into that. I've come across
That's
a lot of people.
That's an understatement.
Yeah.
They're not only into it, but they like to judge it.
Yeah. They are
they're
like,
that's
that.
Bad. That makes you a bad person.
Exactly.
Clearly, you're doing something bad.
And, you know, I'm coming from this suburban background. You know, I have a college degree. I don't do drugs. I don't know.
She has braces.
I have braces. I look like a child, and I'm 24.
She does have a baby face. It's really cute. But she's going to law school.
But hopefully going to law school next fall. And I'm planning on going to law school for these things. I want to break down these stigmas, and I want to be rid of these generalizations on a judicial and social level, to where, you know, we don't have this emotional violence towards sex workers.
Mm-hmm. Talk more about that emotional violence. What do you mean by emotional violence?
You know, obviously we all hear of the cases of physical violence, you know, rape, battery, assault that goes unreported because, you know, sex workers are fearful of having legal retaliation taken upon them because mm-hmm. of their work, whether it's legal or not. Mm-hmm. But there's, you know, this whole world of being judged for what you do that have serious repercussions. Say, for example, you're in the middle of a custody battle and you mm-hmm. have a child and you might be a stripper, a legal job, you know, but you might have that job come back and bite you in the ass because your partner who right. has a straight job, quote unquote.
See, like, look, she's a stripper.
Right, right. So there's right. plenty of cases where that's the case. Or, you know, say you're hurt on the job. You don't have that backing. Right. In that way.
You don't have the same respect from the police either. There's sort of this attitude of like, well, but you're doing sex work, so on some level you might deserve it.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's
awful.
Which is
pretty disgusting. Mm-hmm.
So, Kitty, can you tell us a little bit about your involvement in sex work and sex work activism?
Yeah, I've been doing sex work off and on since I was about 18. Mm-hmm. I started off doing pro-dom work, then went to erotic massage, and mostly stuck with that.
So you were a professional dominant?
Yes, I was professional dominant. Yeah, I like to
do what I say.
I spank men for money is how I usually put it.
That's
and,
awesome.
You know, while I was in the Bay Area, that was what I felt most comfortable with because I was worrying about the legal issues. And
right, because that doesn't always involve sex.
Right.
Using finger quotes when
you know,
I say sex.
Legally, it's really important to remember that any lewd act for money is technically illegal. So a lot of these things, like, for example, being a professional dominant.
Ooh, even spanking someone for money is technically a lewd act?
It could be if a police officer feels the need to prosecute it. So. You know, it is something to be aware of that it's not necessarily safe
right.
because of that. However, if you're white and middle class and working indoors, in all likelihood, you'll be left alone. Hooray
I mean,
for
yay
that.
Yay for that, except that that's not always the case for some
right.
people.
Right.
right. We're not always working indoors. We're not always white.
Exactly. Exactly.
And it should be okay to not be white.
Right?
Yeah.
You would think.
What
year is it again?
Yeah, I know, right?
So then I moved to the United Kingdom. And in the United Kingdom, sex work is actually legal under certain constraints. If you are working independently and you're working indoors, you are generally legally working as a sex worker. You know, you pay taxes and that's that.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found was really interesting was that when it came to issues of dealing with, for example, having something happen on the job, if you had a violent client or an issue like that, you could actually call
someone
the police.
Who wouldn't pay you, for instance,
someone who wouldn't pay you, someone who paid you and then stole the money and ran.
Right.
Anything like that. You could actually call the police. I mean, you know, a lot of the sex workers who are part of the union had a direct number to the vice squad and could call a police officer immediately, which
to the vice squad.
I know, it was pretty amazing.
Mm.
And it felt a lot safer because right. you could negotiate with clients, potential clients, very, very specifically. You didn't have to worry about that. Mm. In the Bay Area, the more specifically you negotiate, the more you have to worry that could be used against you if a police officer is trying to do a sting. If you say, well, I do this for money, but I don't do that. That can be used as evidence that you're doing sex work and you can be arrested for that.
Right.
In the UK, that's not an issue, which also means that the clients are much more respectful because you can say, I do this, I don't do that, and you can be very upfront about it. In the Bay Area, you have to kind of hope when you're actually in the room together that you can negotiate through hand gestures and charades and maybe you guys will actually come to a conclusion about what's okay.
Jeepers. That sounds hard. And you couldn't do
stressful.
Like a form or anything because that would be a paper trail? Because that would at
Very
least
possibly.
Be not verbal, but then it's sort of, I
yeah,
guess it's still
you've
verbal.
Yeah, you got to worry about yeah. any kind of documentation that could be used against you.
Right.
So that makes it a lot more dangerous. I mean, I really liked working in the UK because the clients were much more respectful because they knew you could call the police. So mm-hmm. there was a lot more pressure for them to be respectful. Sex work was talked about a lot more and sex workers had a lot more of a voice over there. You know, they sometimes spoke in front of Parliament, for example, which was pretty cool. There was more of an attitude of sex workers being people and sex workers not just being women. You had male sex workers mm-hmm. who were also very active and vocal. You had trans sex workers who were active and vocal.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a lot more variety. And I think that socially, the reaction was very different. And legally, certainly, it was very different.
Interesting. So as you're back here, what drew you back? I mean, is it just that San Francisco is your home, or?
Well, I say that I've got one foot in San Francisco and one foot in London. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still really, really love London, and not just because sex work is legal, though that's really nice. Mm. But I also had been going back and forth between London and San Francisco for about 4 years. And I was a little tired and kind of wanted to settle in one place. Mm-hmm. And moving to another country is not really very easy.
No, it's not.
So I decided that I was going to stay here, pool my resources, and move over there when I had more of a chance to settle there more permanently.
Right. So tell me about your work doing sex worker activism for people with disabilities.
So one of the areas specifically I work with in London is with people who have either physical disabilities or women who have had sexual trauma histories. Mm. I think it's really interesting that while in the U.S., most of my clients are and were men, and mostly men who weren't disabled, in the U.K., I had about one-fourth of my clients were women, about one-fourth of my clients were couples, one-fourth of my clients were people with disabilities, and one-fourth were sort of your regular Joe.
So you think that because it's legal in the UK, a greater segment of society feels more comfortable visiting a sex worker?
Definitely. I mean, you could have your carer take you to a sex worker, which would be unheard of here. You
right.
know, you could have counsel pay for you to see a sex worker. You had that ability, which is, you know, completely shocking here.
Well, yeah, that is pretty wild. I mean,
it's kind of crazy. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I had a client who was a diplomat's son, actually, and so he got money from his local government to come and see me. He had cerebral palsy.
And, that's sweet.
Had never, you know, he was 20, I think, had never had sex before, had never had any kind of sexual interaction, had never been touched in that way because, you know, a carer is not going to do it.
Right.
So having the option to call a sex worker to come in and say, hey, let's find out what you can do instead of talking about what you can't do, meant that we could open his world up. And, you know, when I met him, he was really shy and anxious and worried. And when I left him, he was really eager to be the next or only, I don't know, star who had cerebral palsy in porn, you know? And
that's
I was
delightful.
Like, fuck yeah, dude, like, you go for it.
Right. Okay, so I think sometimes we think that people with disabilities are like children. They don't really have, you know, a sexuality. And oftentimes people only touch them in like a medical way.
Yeah.
Or like a caretaking way. They don't really touch them in a way that's like, hey, I like you. You know, this feels nice to me. I hope this feels nice to you. And of course, that sometimes they might have a disability that would mean that their place that feels erotically good to them is different than you would expect. Like, I think I heard of someone who had, like, their earlobe was their place of erotic sensation.
Yeah, or hands sometimes, nipples certainly. You know,
and so it really changes your definition of sex.
Definitely. Which, you know, I as a queer girl, you know, I totally got that from the get go. I was like, OK, well, so your penis doesn't work. Whatever. There's
That's
so many other things we can do.
Right, like, exactly.
And I think having that attitude really helps because rather than coming in and being like, oh, well, we can't do the normal stuff. And I say that in quotes. But I don't know what to do with you. And I would come in and be like, well, I've got a strap-on harness, and we could do that on your thigh, and hey, we could try this thing, and
right.
Have you ever tried this before, and how about this? And they were like, wow, I never even thought I had options.
Right.
I thought that I could maybe get a hand job, maybe.
Mm.
I didn't even think about the possibility of getting into fetish or, you know, exploring dirty talk or, you know, all these other things. So it gave me the ability to give them a lot more sexual agency, which I think is hugely important.
Right. So I think it sounds like you're kind of doing a little bit of sex education as you're doing the work, too.
Definitely.
Like you're like teaching people, OK, this is how this works and this is where this goes and look at what I can do with this.
Yeah, it's kind of
you
like...
You think that this is an ordinary garden implement, but no.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there
whatever.
Was definitely a lot of like, you know, here's my bag of tricks.
Uh-huh.
Pick five things that look interesting and let me show you how they work.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you know, it's important to point out that a lot of sex shops are not necessarily accessible, or they might need to take public transit. Transit might not be accessible. London public transit is certainly not accessible for people with disabilities. So, you know, this can often be the only chance that they get to see this stuff in real life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's really meaningful. You know, even hotels, a lot of hotels weren't accessible. So being willing as a sex worker to go to the airport, where there were, in fact, a lot more disability-friendly hotels, meant that my clients could actually see me, while other sex workers who insisted that people go to their in-call, if their in-call wasn't accessible, that meant that they couldn't see them.
Right.
So it sort of it impacts in a lot of other ways that you might not necessarily expect.
Yeah, and I think it's funny because we don't really think about how important it would be for a space to be accessible for someone with disabilities. But then also, I mean, what percentage of people do you think come to you with disabilities here in the United States?
Very few.
Really?
I don't get very many clients who have disabilities. I don't think because of the legality issues and, you know, financial issues.
Oh, because they have to get help.
They would have to get help. And then they'd have to say to where they were going. There's a lot more shame. You know, I think that there's a lot of behavior or sort of societal, social reasons why I don't get as many clients who are disabled here.
Well, it sounds like there's a really big stigma.
Definitely.
Around it, around here. I mean, even when you were mentioning London and stuff, I mean, it was kind of like you'd said, a sex worker, but also kind of like a social worker, but kind of also like a therapist.
Yep.
I mean, it was multifaceted, if you will. I mean, there was a lot of things going on there. And what really struck me when you talked about your experience in London is how the attitude was so much different. I mean, people were really, they were okay with it. It wasn't this big buildup.
I mean, I really appreciate that. Like, I have clients in the UK who their partners know about me and are really comfortable with me being a part of their lives, which is amazing. Like, I think that would be unheard of here. Someone saying, yeah, I've got, you know, this is my sex worker. This is my girlfriend.
Definitely rare.
You know, I think that would be really surprising. Well, in the UK, it was really cool to be able to say to a partner, hey, here's some things that we tried. Here's some supplies so you can give this a go on your own, and making it part of a multifaceted experience and not just about the client, but also the client's partner.
So as you're in the world of sex work and all the different things that you're learning, how do you think that it affects your personal life and your experience of your own sexuality? I mean, do you feel in any way that it makes it more difficult, or do you think that it makes it sometimes more easy to talk about sex? Because I think that I'm not exactly a sex worker. It says sex on my business card. I think that does change things sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, but, you know, people are like, oh, you have a radio show about sex. Let's have sex now. You know,
yeah.
I'm sure you get that too. Like, that's kind of annoying. But then also, it probably makes it a little bit easier for you just to talk about sex with your partner or in
negotiation and consent has become a lot easier for me. Sex work has taught me a lot about boundaries.
Right.
And not just physical boundaries, but emotional boundaries. It's made talking.
Can you say more about that? What are emotional boundaries? What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, when you do sex work, you can have a lot of affection for a client, but being in love with them is really murky and difficult. Having gone down that path before and not doing that again. You know, you can have friendships, like really deep. I mean, a lot of my clients in the UK are really good friends now.
Mm-hmm.
But also having to be like, well, we could be really good friends, but you still have to pay to see me. It's still a job.
Because there's
me.
A right. line there.
Yeah.
Right?
And being able
They're
to
like,
communicate
well, you like
that
me.
In a friendly
Come
way.
On.
And
right.
that must be hard because intimacy kind of blurs that line a little bit for some people.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's that attachment.
Yeah, there's an expectation that if you really care about somebody, you won't need these boundaries, which I have learned to be completely false.
No, you definitely have to separate, if you will, church and state. I mean, you really do. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, definitely. It's also made me really appreciate the value of sex work for people who have dealt with sexual assault. I have several female clients in the UK who have dealt with sexual assault issues, and they came to me to learn how to be touched again because they really struggled with being triggered.
And so they could find someone safe so that if they're like, ah, you're freaking me out, and they're bursting into tears or something,
you
could totally be like, yeah, no worries. They're not like with their partner. There's not that relationship expectation. They're just like, okay, wait,
they don't
I
have
can
to feel
have
guilty.
A sexual sensation and react weirdly to it or angrily or whatever their, you know, their reaction might be, the authentic. And they can do that with a safe person.
And, you know, it taught me a lot about being okay with those reactions in my own life and like how to deal with partners who have had sexual assault histories. It's helped me to understand certain triggers that I have so I can better communicate to a partner. Oh, if you say this thing or you do this thing and I react in this way, this is what I need from you. Hmm. Because I've learned how to have those conversations through talking about it with my clients on the other side of it.
Can you say more about that? Because I every now and then get a little triggered. Like sometimes when my boyfriend grabs my butt, I'm like, hey, you know, and I have this really big reaction and he loves me and he respects me and he's not grabbing my butt like they used to grab my butt in high school. Like it's totally different, right? He loves me. He respects me. He's not a misogynist. He's a nice person. But sometimes when people touch my butt, I want to kill them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they whatever, it feels grabby, feels like they're not relating with my face at all. They're like back there.
Well, I think also it's like the word you said, trigger.
Exactly.
It takes you back to high school. Yeah. It takes you back to that negative place.
You know, and you didn't even know who grabbed your butt and you're all like, what's going on? And it's all crowded. And you know what I mean? They're not doing it because they think you're a special flower.
Or they respect you or love you or care about you.
Exactly. And so how do you, how do you negotiate that when you're feeling all like, ah, just don't touch my butt anymore, okay?
I use a lot of internet research.
That's kind of lame too, right?
A lot of internet stuff about why, yes, as a guy, you might think a response like, you know, how would you feel if I was grabbing your butt all the time? A lot of guys will say, that would be great.
Right,
exactly.
You have
to explain to them, like, yeah, but imagine that it happens in the street and it's strangers and you don't feel safe and you don't know if it's just a grab on the butt or if
they're going to. Or if you're about ready to be assaulted.
Right, exactly. Right. And that, I think, has a lot more of an impact. My partner gets lectured a lot. He's become quite the angry little feminist himself, which I'm
I know, isn't that great?
About.
You're converting them.
It's adorable. but I mean, yeah, I think it's important to be able to have those conversations and say, hey, if I say don't touch my butt, you know, it's not just don't touch my butt because I don't love you. It's
right.
I do care about you, but I want you to express love in a way that I can receive it. And not just in a way that's you projecting your love at me.
Right. Like, I love you and I'm going to touch your butt right now. Well, okay, so, Actually, what I'm starting to kind of try to work on is, like, finding ways for him to touch my butt that I feel loved.
Yeah,
there
and
you
it's
go.
A very important thing to, like, find those things for yourself,
right?
Too. Like,
yeah.
Find, like, is it this way? Or, like, if it's paired with a kiss at the same time,
right, exactly.
Does that make a difference?
It does. Mm-hmm. It makes a huge difference. And if it's, like, a gentle touching of my butt rather than a grabby one, it's totally different.
Mm-hmm.
I don't react with quite so much rage. If it's a gentle pat, I actually think that feels good. As long as it's, you know, not a far away, just, like, you know, because sometimes they feel like, you know, and they're like reaching far away. And they, you know what I mean? And it's like, doink. You know, I can touch your butt because I used to be your boyfriend or something. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it's like, well, actually, that's my butt. And if you would, you know how when you're petting a cat and you can tell that a cat wants to be petted because it moves closer to you?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's also really important. Like when you're interacting with someone, just don't reach out and like grab them. Like get close to them first and put your arm around them in a kind of a neutral way. And then, you know, see if they move into your touch or if they're kind of stiff and weird or whatever. Then that probably means back off.
Yeah. Speaking from a guy's perspective, sometimes we lurch, we lunge,
right,
we grab.
Well, and it seems like it's right there and it's just asking you to touch it, but it's not.
Well, and we should
taught
and,
that.
And we should know. Yeah, exactly. We were right. And it's kind of, you know, media, society, growing up. But I mean, even though, again, going back to been around the block once or twice, we should know, being males, that girls don't like to do that. They're not all about the visual. They're not all about the grabby. They're not all about. Sometimes it's taking it slow, right? I mean, you don't go from first base to home. Uh-oh, I'm looking at the two girls and I'm reading these two girls and she's like, I don't think so.
Well,
you can go all the way home.
Sometimes people are different and I think that there's a lot of people on a lot of different scales. And as women get more safe with a more robust and aggressive sexuality, sometimes we're able to feature that in our own sexuality so we can go from 0 to 60 in, you know, 3.2 seconds.
But you should be able to read that in your partner, exactly. Even if it's the
or
first time.
Or just ask them.
Yes.
Yeah. And
like,
yeah,
is this what you want?
Definitely. I think there can be any range of you know, how people are sexually. It doesn't necessarily have to be like a man is like this or a woman's like this.
Right.
But definitely being able to read your partner's reactions to things is important. And like, once you know why they're reacting that way and what their triggers are, like, doing good to those things is very
right.
important. And that's,
and
that should be part
good
of the relationship.
You know, yeah. They're erotic triggers, the ones that make them go, now I want to rip your clothes off, right? I mean,
yeah.
Those are good things to know too.
Well, I mean, I found one of the things that really helped with my partner was explaining to him, like, look, if you back off, I can go forward.
Right.
But if you're always in my face, then I have no room to move.
Right. Because then
so
you're
backing me into a corner. Don't back me in a corner, and you'll be amazed at how much I'll project myself back at you.
Right.
So we can have a give and take here, but you have to give me the space to do that.
Right. It is nice to have that push and pull and have space to chase them, you know?
Well, and actually to do the loop back into the whole strip club thing again, you know, like the grabbiness and the catcalling and stuff is mm-hmm. part of that whole society that says that women have the sex and men want the sex but don't have it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can teach your male partner, like, hey, you have the sex and I want it sometimes and I will actually request it,
mm-hmm.
but you have to let me do that.
Mm-hmm.
Guys are actually, I mean, they're generally stunned. They're really happy when women hit on them. They're really happy when you initiate sex.
Right.
But
yeah.
if they initiate sex all
yes,
the time.
Yes, I'm agreeing 100%. Yes,
yeah.
yes, yes.
And if they initiate sex all the time, there's no space or time for you to initiate.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so they feel like you don't actually want them because you are never doing it to them. But they need to back off so you can.
Right. So how do we encourage a more, I'm not using the word aggressive, but like a more
yin yang.
Yeah, a female sexuality that is about getting what they want to and actually asking for it. And I mean, how, you know, getting women to feel safe admitting that they're turned on or.
Well, I think one of the things is that it's really important to remember that when a woman says that she's turned on by something, it doesn't mean that she'll be turned on by that all the time. Or that because she's a sexual
right.
being, it doesn't mean that she wants to have sex constantly. If she does sex work, it doesn't mean that she's constantly turned on, etc. You know, and asking for consent can be sexy.
Mm-hmm.
You can make it part of your dirty talk. You can make it part of your sexual foreplay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's even hotter when you do that
mm-hmm.
because both of you feel comfortable. The more comfortable you feel, the safer you feel, the safer you feel. You know, the crazier things can get, really,
mm-hmm.
because you feel safe enough to explore that.
Well, I thought being a comedian was a bad occupational hazard. Whenever you tell somebody you're a comic, they're like, oh, really? Tell me a joke.
Right.
Oh, yes. My gosh.
For
so you guys get it all the time. You get it all the time. Oh, yeah. Show me a little kind of thing or whatever.
Yeah. I'm very vocal about being a sex worker. If I'm meeting somebody for the first time, like, I can expect one of two reactions. You know, the
yeah.
first reaction usually is like, oh, that's weird. I'm going to shut down. Not going to talk to you anymore.
Right.
A lot of reactions
yeah.
I get from men are, now I can be more lewd with you. We
right.
can start talking about porn. We can start talking about like different sex positions. We can start being
right.
really explicit.
So that's, we're trying to go from first to home.
Exactly. And
right.
not necessarily, you know, because they don't necessarily want to go home with the sex worker. They don't necessarily want to try to impress me and, you know, have anything continuous with me. But they feel that they can push that because I do these things, that I can talk about these things all the time, and that's who I am all the time.
Right.
So, you know, instead of talking about movies and music like we were 2 seconds ago, it's, you know,
right.
what's your favorite porn? And would you do this in bed? And
oh, my.
Yeah, it goes
right.
to
wow,
a whole
I'm
new
I'm
level.
Off the clock, man. I really don't want to talk about work anymore, you know,
yeah.
that kind of thing. So.
And neither do I. I mean, you know, sometimes I do. I do in a lot of ways. I talk about activism. I
right.
talk about really awesome things that happen at work. But I don't want to go all the through, you know, the dirty details and all the things I see every day and like, what's the weirdest thing you've ever done?
God, man, I'd be so much more comfortable with that conversation. The one that I always get is like, especially in the UK, I used to say, well, I'm a sex worker, because, you know, at the pub, someone will say, oh, what do you do? And you have to decide, like, oh, do I want to have that conversation again? And guaranteed within 5 minutes, they'd be crying into their beer and saying, oh, God, I don't know how to make my girlfriend want to have sex with me. So rather than it being the, oh, let's talk about sexy fun time stuff, which I'm actually way more comfortable with, I get the, oh, God, help me emotionally. For which my fee is a beer, by the way. So if you buy me a beer, I will talk to you about it as long as there is beer. When the beer is gone, so am I.
Right. Huh. Okay. So, yeah, there is a whole thing, though, about people getting into long-term domestic monogamous relationships, and then the sex kind of goes away. However, I do know someone whose job that is, who's decided to take it upon herself to help people revive the drive of their partner. It's called Revive Her Drive. So just be like, hey, buddy, www.reviveherdrive.com.
There we go.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about SWAP. SWAP is the Sex Worker Outreach Project. What got you involved in that?
I started getting involved a few months ago. I had heard about this group. It's a national organization. They have chapters.
And what do they do?
They do outreach. They sometimes do street outreach. Mostly, though, the group is composed of women who are prostitutes who work out of their homes or out of in-call spaces and get people off the internet. Mm-hmm. So you can see that there's definitely a class type in that way. They focus on harm reduction. They want
so
to see
education. Like, this is how you can do this more safely.
Yeah, so they focus on a lot of different things.
They talk about maybe STI transmission and ways of reducing.
Yeah,
risk.
They do a lot of different things. There are social things that happen just for the sake of community, which is super important if you're a sex worker, and especially if
so
you're,
you can have people to talk to about what you do or not.
Right,
depending
right.
on what you feel like doing.
Yeah,
right.
Talk about it.
We find places, to go that are maybe a little bit more private or a little bit louder so you don't overhear everything that's said. I mean, you can have a space that's just for that purpose of being with people in your community, because sometimes you don't have anybody to talk to and you aren't out with anybody about anything. So it's really important to have that space. We also have meetings once a month about, what are we going to do for the next few months? Where is our money going to go? Filling out grants so we can put on classes, so we can put on events.
All run by sex workers?
It's all run by sex workers.
That's cool.
Male, female, transgender. We have the space to have anybody come, regardless of class and anything. It's a very important place for people in the Bay Area, because there are so many different niches. Like, you can have your GLBT center and still not feel comfortable coming out in the different ways that you're out.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I really enjoy about SWAP is that it's also open to all different types of sex work. Like, I was a part of the International Union of Sex Workers in the UK, and that was almost exclusively escorts.
Right.
In the Bay Area, SWAP, at least, we have people who work at the Peep Show. We have people who are strippers. We have people who are professional dominants. We have people who are escorts. We have people who do erotic massage. So it covers a lot more ground, which especially when you talk about class is hugely important, because not generally there's been a hierarchy of sex work.
Let's talk a little bit about that. What if someone didn't know?
There can be a lot of sort of intersex work prejudice, like, professional dominants might look down on escorts because we don't do that.
Because they don't actually have penis-vagina intercourse, so they feel like, well, I don't do that.
Right. Well, similarly, escorts might look down on professional dominants, be like, yeah, but, you're not even doing that. Yeah. You just dress up in a funny costume, whatever. So there can be that. There could be, a lot of strippers don't identify necessarily as sex workers.
And also porn workers or webcam
porn workers,
girls
webcam.
Also don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, there can be that doesn't include us. Mm-hmm. And I think that I've been really excited to see how much SWAP works to outreach to all those different types of sex workers, right, and build community around those different types of sex workers. So it's not
right, because what you're trying to do is say separate. There's nothing wrong with sex work. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with being a sex worker.
Right. Any kind of sex worker. Right. Like, we, right, you know, we don't really care. Like, if you're doing lewd acts for money, great, awesome, come on down.
Yeah. There are a lot of people who don't, you know, like strippers and people who are into porn who don't necessarily think that they share the same interests with people who are escorts or prostitutes on the street, because they feel like, you know, we have rights because our job is legal. And it doesn't quite work that way, because you still kind of face the same stigmas every day and a lot of the same legal obstacles. And SWAP is a place where that can totally come together. There are a lot of like online resources for specific groups, like, you know, strippers or porn people, but there isn't really a lot out there for everybody.
What do you guys think normal, I'm going to use finger quotes when I say normal, mm-hmm, people, what do you think normal people get out of sex work and sex work activism?
Well, I mean, I think it's an additional resource. I mean, like, why wouldn't you go to an expert to learn about something? You know, what are sex workers if not, yeah, mm-hmm, experts in their field? One of the things that I write about in my blog is that, hey, you know, if you want to have a threesome, but you're worried about lots of drama, book a sex worker, because they'll come
true.
In. You know they're going
to
leave,
and
you
don't
know
have
they
to
don't
call
care.
Them again,
yeah. Right? You know, they'll come, mm-hmm, in, they'll do the job, they'll do it beautifully.
They're not
going to
steal your boyfriend.
Yeah, and then they'll leave. It's brilliant. Right. You know, everyone's happy. For clients who are curious about bisexuality, you might not feel comfortable actually hooking up with a guy from, you know, Craigslist, but you might feel comfortable booking a sex worker who, again, will be discreet, will come, and you'll get to explore at your pace, and then they'll go away, and you can think about what that experience was like.
Right.
You know, my clients with disabilities, they can have all these sexual experiences and realize the variety that's available to them. I mean, I think it's an incredibly valuable resource.
Right. Well, Kitty Stryker, thank you so much for coming on the program. How can people find you?
Well, I have a blog, but honestly, the easiest way to look it up, because the name of it's Perversatility and no one can ever spell
it. Hard to spell,
is
yeah,
just look up Kitty Stryker on Google. You'll find me.
Okay.
There's
it's KITTYSTRYKER.
It is indeed.
And Sandy Bottoms.
Yeah, I also have a blog. It's missbottomsup@blogspot.com. You can find it by Googling Diary of a Peep Show Princess. I chronicle my life of the lusty lady. I chronicle what I've experienced in conjunction with school and family. I talk about relationships. So kind of all these things all rolled into one.
Paul, how can people find your show?
Same studio, 1A, every Sunday from 4 to 6 for The Edge of Insanity, and then from 6 to 8 on Get Your Fill. And you can follow us on Edge of Insanity Productions at Twitter.
This is Sexploration with Monica.
You can download free podcasts at sexplorationwithmonica.com.